Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs, New York, and recorded before a live audience. Two-time Pulitzer winner, New York Times bestselling author, and master historian David McCullough brings to life two of the most iconic figures in American history in his new book, The Wright Brothers. David McCullough won Pulitzers for his biographies Truman and John Adams. He is the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian award, and it is a great pleasure to welcome David McCullough to this week's book show. Do you ever get sick of that?
Never. Thank you, Joe, and thank you, everybody, very much.
I can't tell you what a pleasure it is and a privilege to speak to you. I have had the great fortune of speaking to you for, I think, your last five or six books, and it's my great honor every time I get to speak to you. And I'm curious as to how you came to this, because I can guess, but I don't know. Because when I read The Wright Brothers, when I initially saw that you were coming out with this book, I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. That's an interesting choice. And then when I read it, I saw the very, very close connection to Paris, knowing the last book had so much, obviously, A Greater Journey, about Paris, that would be the connector.
You're quite right. It's what I was reading into those Americans who went to Paris, not just the 19th century, but on into the 20th century, who went to improve their abilities as architects and artists and physicians and the rest. In the 20th century, the first few years of the 20th century, I discovered Wilbur and Orville Wright and their sister Catherine, all in France. And I was astonished. What were they doing in France, of all people? And then I found out that they were not only there seeing the place, but they were doing very important work for their progress and their desire, their need to make the world realize that they could fly. Because in our country, there had been little or no interest in them. They were just taken as a couple of crackpots. And then I began reading about Wilbur's interest in art and architecture, his knowledge of history, and I thought there's a lot more here about these two extraordinary Americans that I want to know and that everybody ought to know. And it was quite soon that I realized this is my next book. And I also saw it as book number three of a trilogy, which began with my book on the Great Bridge, the Brooklyn Bridge, and the Panama Canal. All three of these accomplishments happened within roughly the same amount of time. They were all very daring, unprecedented, dangerous, monumental in importance, and took lives, and everyone involved experienced tremendous setbacks of a kind that would make most people give up, and they succeeded. I also have become increasingly devoted to the task of making it clearer than it has been that history is much more than just politics and war. Yes, politics and war count a lot, but so does art and music and science and technology and finance, adventure and philosophy, high dreams. And if we leave that out, we're leaving out a large part of the human side of history. History is human. When in the course of human events, the fact that these two men, with no college education, no connections, no foundation behind them, no university sanctioning their experiments, no political pull, no money, could set out to do what they did and succeed is phenomenal in the extreme, and of course, they changed the world. I would have wanted to have written the book even if they had not succeeded. So compelling is their story, and so much is there to learn from their example as human beings.
In the book, you write about a speech that Wilbur would give later on after the success, and would remark that if he were to give a young man advice on how to get ahead in life, he would say, pick out a good father and mother and begin life in Ohio.
Right.
How much of this is an Ohio story, do you think?
I think it's primarily an Ohio story, but I also think when he says pick out a good mother and father, we don't know enough about how we're brought up at home. I think it's a subject that needs more study. We know, of course, about the importance of education and good, great teaching and all the rest. But how you're brought up at home, how you're raised, is so very important. Among other things, they were raised to be modest. You don't get too big for your britches. They were raised to have purpose in life. They were raised to read and to read as broadly as possible. They were raised to have curiosity and to use the English language correctly and effectively. We are now producing several generations of young Americans who don't write very well. Almost half the business schools in the country are requiring their incoming freshmen, all of whom are college graduates, to take a basic writing course in order to be able to write a presentable letter or proposal or recommendation or whatever. And here are these two young men who never finished high school, whose vocabulary, whose use of the language is superb, both on paper and on their feet, in the case of Wilbur, who was a wonderful public speaker. All that was because of the way they were raised at home. The father and mother insisted on the proper use of the language. Toward the end of his life, Orville was being interviewed by a reporter, and the reporter said that many Americans consider you and your brother to be prime examples of how far an American can get who's had no advantages growing up. And Orville did not like that at all. He said, "That's not true. We had the most important advantage anybody could possibly have, and that is we grew up in a house, a home, that encouraged intellectual curiosity." The other thing that I think we need to keep in mind is that 1903, the year they flew their first flights at Kitty Hawk, seems to most all of it a long time ago. As history goes, it's nothing. It was the other day. Also, Orville Wright didn't die until 1948. Numbers of us here tonight, certainly I and my wife Rosalie, could have known him. We were 15 in 1948. If we'd grown up in Dayton, Ohio, he might have been that nice old gentleman around the corner. And yet, think how the world's changed. This summer, starting June 1 to August 31, 222 million people are going to fly in airplanes. 31 million of them going overseas. And we just take it for granted. We zoom off at 35, 40,000 feet in the air and think, oh yeah, that's how it is. But how did it happen? Who did it? Why did they do it and nobody else ever had? No matter how many tried and no matter how many of those who tried were brilliant as anybody has ever been. Why these two? Why Ohio? And going back to the point about Ohio, it's very interesting, isn't it, that the first human being to fly ever, and the first human being to put his foot on the moon ever, both came from the same southwestern corner of Ohio. Neil Armstrong and Orville Wright. And not coincidentally, another Ohio hero is John Glenn. There's something in the water there, maybe. Also, it has to do with the time. The early part of the 20th century, the latter part of the 19th century, was a time of numerous inventions that changed the world, changed how we live. It was like an inventor's renaissance. The light bulb, the telephone, the elevator, the rat trap, the cash register, on and on, all invented at that time. And Dayton, Ohio, which is the fifth largest town in Ohio, by no means the biggest town in Ohio then, nonetheless, ranked higher in the number of patents issued there higher on a per capita basis than any other city in the country. So Dayton was a red-hot place at that time, and they're right in the midst of it. That's not an incidental aspect of their story. It was an exciting time to be in Dayton and have mechanical or physical or mental ingenuity. I see their story as a great American adventure, both a physical adventure because of the phenomenal courage it took for them to do what they did. Every time either one went up on one of their experimental flights, he knew he stood a very good chance of being killed. And they went up 50 or 100 times a year. But it was also a great intellectual adventure. And their intellectual pioneering was far beyond anything being done at MIT or Rensselaer or at the Smithsonian, far beyond. How did it happen?
David McCullough joins us on this week's book show. His new book is The Wright Brothers, published by Simon & Schuster.
I am fascinated by what you just said about how you could have known Orville Wright. And you make a point in the book that when they are doing their testing, I believe in 1905 at Huffman Prairie, not far from Dayton, and it's successful, that a year later there are dozens of people who are testing, and aeronautics has just exploded in 1 year.
Yeah, it's a little more than a year, but not much more. But it's also fascinating that the press, not just the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune or Scientific American, wouldn't bother to come out and take a look. The reporters from the Dayton papers wouldn't come out and take a look because they knew that these guys were crackpots. Nice fellows, to be sure, very gentlemanly and nicely dressed and always polite, but weird. And of course, man can't fly. The Washington Post stated in no uncertain terms, it must be understood, man can't fly. The government in Washington would not send anybody out to take a look. And when the Wrights volunteered to bring their flying machine to Washington to demonstrate, they had the door slammed in their face three or four times. So it was when a delegation from France showed up in Dayton, very interested, because the French were very much ahead of us in their interest in aviation, not necessarily their progress. This delegation showed up, all in civilian clothes and all but one or two military officers, and said, "We're very interested, and if you please come over, we'll treat you right and maybe start buying some of your airplanes." So it was Wilbur Wright who then went to France for the first time by himself. They shipped one of their flying machines, their 1905 Flyers, it was called, over to Le Havre. As it turned out, it was badly beat up and broken into pieces by the customs officials in Le Havre. And so he had to rebuild the whole thing himself, working with French helpers, mechanics, who couldn't speak English and didn't understand anything he was saying. So he virtually did the whole thing himself. And what he finished was a plane that he'd never flown, but he then flew it. And on the 8th of August, in 1908, the 8th day of the 8th month of the 8th year, in front of a crowd, and for the first time, the world knew that human beings could fly. So, as you probably know, there's great rivalry between Ohio and North Carolina about their license plates. North Carolina says the birthplace of flight, the first to fly. Ohio says the birthplace of flight, both of which are true, and that the first flight was made in North Carolina, and Ohio was where it all got figured out and built, and where a practical airplane was perfected between 1903 and 1905. I think the French have every right to have a license plate, too. It's one of the crucial things to understand is that they didn't just invent the airplane. They invented the airplane and they flew it. And that's exactly comparable and in keeping with bicycles. You can't read about how to ride a bicycle. You have to get on the bicycle and ride it. learn to use balance, or in aviation it's called equilibrium. Now, people like Octave Chanute and Samuel Langley, the great head of the Smithsonian, one of the most prominent scientists of his day, all developed their version of a glider or a powered flying machine. But there was no thought of flying it. We'd leave that to somebody else. The Wright brothers got on the untamed horse and rode it in order to tame it. And how they did that is so elemental, so simple, and so obvious, one would think, that one wonders why hadn't everybody else done it. They studied how soaring birds soar. How can they stay up there without flapping their wings? And vultures and hawks and gannets were their favorites to watch, particularly at Kitty Hawk. And the gannet is, if you don't know, is a bird with a 6-foot wingspan. Huge, beautiful bird. And to see that bird soaring in the wind over the beaches and sand dunes of Kitty Hawk was for them one of the thrills of their lives. But let me just read, if I may,
please,
how it affected the locals who came out to watch these strange men who had arrived from Ohio and who wore business suits, coats, and ties out working on their so-called flying machines. Nobody on the Outer Banks wore a coat and tie except at weddings and funerals. And here they were, and their conclusion was that they were not quite balanced. For the local citizens, the two brothers from Ohio were extremely hard to figure. This is what John T. Daniels, who's one of the locals, wrote. "We couldn't help thinking they were just a pair of poor nuts. They'd stand on the beach for hours at a time just looking at the gulls, flying, soaring, dipping. They would watch the gannets and imitate the movements of their wings with their arms and hands." Imagine this in business suits. They could imitate every movement of the wings of those gannets. "We thought they were playing crazy, but we just had to admire the way they could move their arms this way and that and bend their elbows and wrist bones up and down and which way, just exactly like the gannets." Later on, Orville said, "Learning the secret of flight from a bird was a good deal like learning the secret of magic from a magician." It's so simple. And then you look at what they came from. They grew up in a house that had no running water, no plumbing, no indoor plumbing, no electricity, no telephone. But it was a house full of books. The father stocked it with books of all kinds, novels, Sir Walter Scott, Mark Twain, books on natural history. It was all there, theology, and agnostics, where Ralph Ingersoll. They all read Ralph Ingersoll, and their father was a bishop in the church. He was an itinerant minister, and he encouraged them to read Ingersoll. He wanted them to have broad minds, and they did. What happened to Wilbur changed his life and changed the world, because it caused a whole swerve in the direction of his life that affected not only him, but history consequently. In a hockey game, when he was about 18, he was hit in the teeth with a hockey stick by another player. It knocked all of his upper teeth out. It was terribly painful for weeks, and he went into what we today would call depression. And it got worse, and he had stomach trouble, and he felt very insecure. And he retreated into self-imposed seclusion at home. It was then that he began really reading, not just the stock of books that was in the house, but everything he could bring home from the public library. And in effect, he gave himself a superb liberal arts education. Orville, the younger brother, who always followed whatever Wilbur led him to do — Wilbur was the big brother, the leader, and Wilbur was a genius, there's no question about it — also followed what Wilbur was reading. So these two men, who cracked one of the most difficult of all highly technical, mechanical, engineering problems of all time, had at the base a liberal arts education. And my hope is that what I've written in this book will have some emblematic, symbolic effect on those who are trying to pull back on the liberal arts education in order to give students a better chance in science and technology. It doesn't work that way.
Let me just quick go through a lightning round. I want to talk about this. You mentioned the press, the major press, not really covering the story early on. Ultimately, the story was broken by a B journal.
A little fellow named Amos Root. Tom Hanks has decided he wants to make a miniseries for HBO of this book, as he did with my Adams book. And I hope very much Paul Giamatti will play Amos Root. Amos Root was a beekeeper and had a little bee magazine. He sold beekeeping equipment, not just in Ohio, but throughout the country. And he made a considerable fortune at it. And he was interested in everything. And he got wind of what the Wright brothers were up to. He lived up in northeastern Ohio. And he got in his automobile. This is back when automobiles were all new, too. Let's not forget. And he drove all the way down to Dayton to see what was going on, saw what was going on, and wrote a long, thorough, and accurate account of the Wright brothers flying. And it was the first published account of what they had done, which appeared in 1905. He then sent it to Scientific American saying, here's what I've seen, here's what I've written. The article is yours to publish if you wish, and you may do so without paying me anything. He never heard from him. Just totally ignored it. But isn't it wonderful that the ingenuity, the eyes to see what's really happening, that the king has no clothes, are there among us somewhere almost all the time. I'd like to point out one other wonderful, to me, sad and strange, but an aspect of the story that keeps it in the balance of reality. The boy who hit Wilbur in the teeth, his identity has never been known, but we found it. His name was Oliver Howe, and he was the neighborhood bully. And whether he hit Wilbur intentionally or accidentally, we don't know. But what we do know, he went on to be one of the most notorious murderers in the history of the state of Ohio.
Wiped out his family.
He wiped out his mother, father, and brother, and an estimated 12 others besides. And he grew up right in the same neighborhood, right around the corner. So it wasn't exactly a Norman Rockwell kind of setting altogether. True. No, truly. And we have to remember that. There was genius and purpose and courage and character, but there was also evil right there.
And he could have been high on cocaine.
Yes, he could have, because he... It's so sad. His father was a house painter, had no money, too many children. The children all had to work. This boy went to work as a clerk at the local drugstore, suffering from terribly rotting teeth, and the druggist, feeling sorry for him, started giving him cocaine pills, which was the only anesthetic available then. Mm. And he became addicted. He became an alcoholic. He had to be put away in a mental institution for a while. But again, right in the same neighborhood, same drugstore that the Wright brothers and their family would have gone to.
You write in the book that the whole episode seems to have been something the family wished to put behind them and remains a dark corner in Wilbur's life about which too little is known, but clearly it changed the course of his life. What do you think we do not know? What is not known there?
Well, the main thing is, was it intentional? And was he jealous of Wilbur or mad at him, or was it? We just don't know. I wish we knew more. The only way we know anything about it is that after Wilbur died much too young. He died of typhoid fever in 1912 when he was still in his mid-40s. The next year, 1913, his father recorded in his diary who it was that had hit Wilbur in the teeth and that he went on to become the mass murderer. But we then looked into the whole story of this killer because he was ultimately executed. Of course, great deal in the papers about his whole story and how he'd grown up in Dayton.
David McCullough's new book is The Wright Brothers. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We'll continue our conversation with David McCullough on next week's book show. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can also listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Saratoga Springs, New York, in partnership with Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.